Hello, and welcome to episode number 91 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. Over the course of 90-plus episodes of Point of Convergence, save for one episode with James Iandoli on the topic of CE5, or HICE, that is, human-initiated contact events, this show has not followed the common podcast interview format. The reason for that is that there are already plenty of shows following that common interview pattern. My goal here has generally been to offer solo deep dives on various aspects of the UFO phenomenon and associated topics that include, among others, NDEs, OBEs, and psi phenomena. That said, as is the case with my interview with James Iandoli, who represents a wealth of wisdom on so-called contact work, I do find it helpful to include the thoughts of others when that person represents what I would deem a paragon in their field. This is true in today's episode, which features my recent conversation with philosopher Bernardo Kastrup. Bernardo's work has been featured prominently in this podcast. His analytic idealism framework has been influential in my own aim to make sense of the dizzying and sometimes discombobulating array of phenomena associated with anomalous encounters with UFOs/UAP and apparent aliens. His book, Meaning and Absurdity, What Bizarre Phenomena Can Tell Us About the Nature of Reality, is especially pertinent to our overarching subject of interest, and I highly recommend it. As an idealist, Bernardo's view is that base reality is ultimately mental in nature, like a dream held in what he calls mind at large, or what others might call source consciousness or original mind. I have found that seeing not just the UFO phenomenon and related paranormal encounters, but reality itself in this light, is extremely helpful in making headway in these tricky, murky waters. With that introduction aside, let's move to part one of my two-part discussion with philosopher Bernardo Kastrup in this, the 91st episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. Bernardo, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
All right. So one thing I find really interesting about your particular background is that you've kind of been both in the hard sciences world and physics, as well as dealing in metaphysics and philosophy. So I think that gives you a unique perspective. So you've been both fully embedded in the world of the hard sciences and even worked at the lion's den, you could say, of the physicalist proving ground at CERN, while also pursuing a PhD in philosophy, where you've been a leading thinker in wrestling with metaphysical matters. What advantages do you see that you've gained by having a foot in both worlds?
It's always difficult for one to make this sort of self-analysis because I don't have any other reference, right? I only know myself to the extent that I know myself. Without meaning to take a cheap shot at some of my colleagues, that's not the meaning. I'm just trying to answer your question. There are philosophers who are not incompetent, but they deal purely with abstraction, conceptual abstraction. And that can unground you. It can disconnect you from the solidity of reality. Because when you are in the realm of pure abstraction and the only arbiter for truth you have are some logical axioms that cannot be used to prove themselves, anything goes. While, you know, when you come down to experiment or to engineering, you either see the results or you don't. And it doesn't matter that you think your theory is so beautiful, it should be right. If the results are not consistent with it, then it's just wrong. I mean, I have gone through this when I was working at CERN as a youngster, early 20s. My motivation for doing what I was doing was not to find the Higgs boson. We knew the Higgs boson existed since the LEP, the previous generation accelerator, at a much lower energy. There were events of the Higgs boson. We just didn't have statistics to claim a discovery. So everybody knew that the LHC would find the Higgs boson, but what I wanted to find was supersymmetry, SUSY. And it's not there. And it doesn't matter that I find it so absolutely beautiful and wonderful that it must be true. It doesn't seem to be. And to get used to this, or in engineering, you come up with a beautiful design and you build it and then you turn it on and it doesn't work. It doesn't matter that it's beautiful. It doesn't work. So you always have this grounding thing in experimental science and in engineering, but you don't have that in philosophy. So philosophers need to actively look for that. Otherwise, they may go off to the races and never be seen again. They are operating in a world of pure abstraction and that they believe in, but which has little relationship with reality. So I think having this double background at least keeps me aware that this grounding is needed, that I can't just go off on a tangent without empirical grounding. So that's what I try to do.
Right, indeed. And before we went on the air, we were talking a bit about our backgrounds and we discussed AI briefly. Now, I think you've discussed before how, I think while you were working at CERN, you were tasked with some sort of AI task. And partly that process is what led you to realize some things about the nature of reality. So what was it about trying to either create consciousness or the idea of uploading consciousness via AI that you shifted your perspective on, and that sort of led you into something like idealism?
Well, the work we did on AI was illicit. We were working on a data acquisition system of the Atlas experiment. And what that system had to do was to make a decision every 25 nanoseconds about the data that we are seeing in the experiment. Is this new physics that we should store for offline analysis, or is this old physics that we have to discard? You can't store everything. The experiment produces many terabytes per second of data. So we were using classical algorithms based on an understanding of physics to make that decision. But illicitly, on the side, we were trying to solve the same problem using artificial neural networks. And lo and behold, the neural networks were just as good as the algorithm based on deep theoretical understanding of physics. It is the classical algorithm that was used because it's more conservative. Physicists know what's happening. With a neural network, you have a kind of a black box. It works, but you don't know how how it's doing the discrimination that it's doing. So we shelved the neural networks, but it stayed in my mind. If I can make a neural network that is as clever as a physicist in classifying this leading edge data, what does it take for me to make it conscious? And of course, that was a misunderstanding. Intelligence has nothing to do with consciousness, other than for the fact that they happen to be both present in us. But that's about it. They are completely different things. I thought about that for a couple of years. How do I make it conscious? Until I realized that whatever I would imagine doing to the circuit, it would only ever change function and structure. And it would give me no more and no less reason to think that it's conscious or not. And then you hit a wall and you realize that you've taken a wrong turn somewhere. And now you are in an alley with no exit. You have to retrace your steps back to the point where you took that wrong turn, re-examining your assumptions and questioning your assumptions all the way back so you can correct your way. And to me, the assumption I needed to correct was this notion that consciousness is somehow generated by material arrangements. Because as far as I or anyone else could ever know for sure, all material arrangements are perceptions or plans in a consciousness. The consciousness precedes material arrangements, epistemologically speaking, in a very fundamental way. And that started me off this path of trying to come up with an alternative but coherent worldview in terms of which I could relate to the world again, because I was like in free fall. I didn't have solid ground to step on. I never thought about writing a book. I was thinking about this stuff for myself. I was very uncomfortable in that phase of my life in which I realized materialism is nonsense. But then what? But dualism? No, that doesn't work. So then what? What? And so I was doing that for myself, and the book story came afterwards and took on a life of its own, something I never planned for my life. But here we are.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I was going to ask you about that, actually, because so it sounds like you almost accidentally stumbled upon this through an experimental process trying to develop AI that could become conscious. I'm just curious, when you went from that place of the free fall, kind of the dark night of the soul for physicalism, and you arrived at something like idealism. What was it like when you had that? I'm talking about how it felt here, not so much like a cerebral process, but how did it feel for you when you suddenly had a completely different understanding of the nature of reality, perhaps even the purpose of human life, those kinds of things? How did that shift who you were from who you were as a physicalist?
I was never a thinking physicalist. I was a physicalist by default because my entire environment was physicalist. I didn't think about that. There was never one aha moment in which idealism suddenly descended from the ether and became absolutely clear and self-evident to me. That's not how it went. I was doubting it all the way. I was asking myself questions all the way because for me, it was not about having a good argument to publish a paper. That's nothing. For me, it was a narrative, a story in terms of which I could live in the world. The stakes were much higher than whether I could publish a paper or not. And you cannot bullshit yourself knowingly, if you know what I mean. So I could not bullshit myself knowingly. I had to truly convince myself that idealism added up, that it was empirically adequate, that it was logically and internally consistent, that it was parsimonious and all that stuff. And I tried to refute it for quite a while. So that process of my buying into it happened gradually over several years. Did it change me? I think that change was also gradual. There was never a moment in which, you know, suddenly you have a realization and you are a different person. To me, that didn't happen. Even when I became intellectually convinced of idealism, in the early days, it was sort of a conceptual construct in my head. It didn't remodulate my emotional life. It didn't change the way how I felt in the world. And it sinks from the conceptual intellect into a more holistic, whole realization of truth over time, at least for me. I mean, I'm pretty hard-headed, so I don't mean by this that everyone should have the same kind of laborious process. Some people just see it like at the drop of a hat. I'm not like that. I have whatever limitations I have. But today, looking back, I realized that, it has sunk in, right? Today, it has definitely changed how I live my life, how I feel about life, how I feel about things, about other people. It changed everything. But never suddenly. It's the kind of change, comprehensive change, that you just realize in hindsight. When you look back 5 years earlier and you say, I was there then and now I'm here. Wow, a lot has changed. But along the way, I would wake up every day thinking, no, it's all the same.
Right. And when did you first come across idealism? Like you mentioned how dualism wasn't something you would opt for, but if you remember coming across it as an undergrad or something, what process did you go through to examine like different notions, even like solipsism, before you arrived at idealism as the best model?
I used to read philosophy when I was a kid. I liked it. I was always a philosopher. Whether having the degree or not, it's irrelevant. People are either born philosophers or they are not, right? And I think most people are born philosophers. So I used to read a lot of philosophy, but including Kant, you know, the notions of noumena and phenomena, the critique of pure reason, the critique of practical reason, which was a disaster of a book, especially in contrast with the one that preceded it. So I think ideas related to idealism were germinating in my mind since very early, but I never explicitly recognized it. I never read Kant as an idealist, even though he's called a sort of epistemic idealist, transcendental idealist. I never read him as an idealist because I didn't see him making ontological statements. He made epistemic statements, statements about what we can and what we cannot know, not about what is or what isn't. All of these ideas, and then I was a teenager, started reading Jung, and Jung never used the word idealism, referring to his own work. But today, as an adult, I know he was an idealist through and through. I wrote a book about it. But this realization that, oh, Jung was an idealist, that came in my adulthood. It's possible, however, to think that all of that reading planted the seeds of idealism in my mind avant la lettre, without the name, without that label, idealism. And that when the time came that I was left without a worldview, that those seeds that were there all along began to germinate, because suddenly an alternative was needed. So there was psychic energy going into that at a sort of subconscious level. So you could think it was like that, but I didn't read a book defending idealism and thinking, okay, this is it, this is the answer. That's not how it happened.
One of the things I think that really is a dual tour de force right now in our conversation about the nature of reality is both your work and the work of someone like Donald Hoffman as well, because he's really demonstrated, even mathematically through game theory and things like that, that our intuitions about reality based on our perceptual set, the way that we actually access what we think is the world, is actually more like an interface. And there's these icons that the evolutionary process has produced to allow us to navigate an incredibly complex barrage of data. So when you think about idealism actually gaining traction in the mainstream and in popular culture in general and academia, do you see the biggest challenge being the actual arguments themselves or the fact that people's intuitions get in the way?
It's definitely people's culture-bound intuitions. These are not natural-born intuitions. These are not intrinsic intuitions. These are intuitions that are sort of hammered into us by culture, because we hear from our parents, we hear from the 8 o'clock news anchor, from our doctors, things that are consistent with a narrative of reality that is untenable, but we trust that people before us have done the thinking required to know whether it was tenable or not, and they seem to have decided that it was tenable. So we go along for the ride. We don't need to rethink the whole thing, to be critical about the whole thing, because people before us have thought this through, right? No, wrong. They hardly thought this through. They were also moved by all kinds of political, social, and psychological motivations that have absolutely nothing to do with reason and evidence. Idealism was born as a socio-political lever to make sure that the church wouldn't burn every scientist at the stake like they burned Bruno in 1600. Denis Diderot, one of the two authors of La Encyclopédie, the founding document of the Enlightenment in the 18th century, is on record saying, well, we know materialism doesn't work, but we need to use it as a weapon against the church. And so people were aware of that until mid-19th century, with Darwin, and now it was not only about surviving the church, now it was about quashing the church, making sure that the bourgeoisie, the intellectual elite, had cultural hegemony over society and not the church. At that point, we forgot that this stuff was a socio-political tool. It was not meant as a true answer to the nature of reality. And then we completely lost our way in the early 20th century with, the fairy tales of logical positivism, and then later on behaviorism and Skinner's black box. Those were the decades of absolute darkness in which we completely lost touch with our natural intrinsic intuitions of plausibility in favor of manufactured, culture-bound intuitions. And to this day, those manufactured intuitions are the greatest obstacle towards not even embracing, but giving idealism a fair hearing. Because most people, when they are evaluating idealism, they are doing that unknowingly on the basis of physicalist assumptions. Things like mind can only exist within the nervous system of living beings. Now, wait a moment, this is true under physicalism. It's not a fact of nature that we know empirically. And people mistake this knee-jerk, culture-bound assumptions that come from physicalism with facts. And they use them in their thinking process, evaluating idealism. They use these culture-bound axioms of physicalism as fact. And somebody, or even dualism. Dualism is still very strong because of our religious past. And this comes back in the questions they ask. I deal with it every day. So yeah, the culture-bound intuitions are the challenge, not reason, not evidence.
Right. Now, another thing that you and I have in common, in addition to metaphysics, is an interest in the UFO phenomenon. I know that you've been interested in this a long time. So I wanted to ask you, what was your initial introduction into the depths of the enigma that is the UFO phenomenon? How have your views on this matter evolved over time? And here I'm thinking especially of the recent revelations that were put forward by David Grush, alleging the recovery not just of apparently non-human tech, but also apparently alien bodies.
You mean my introduction in terms of literature?
Well, that's up to you. It could be an experience. Maybe you saw something, or maybe you just were always interested in it because of science fiction.
Then, if I am to ever tell this, I guess this is the moment.
Okay, here we go.
Or I might as well shut up forever. It's not really a secret. I think I mentioned this some other places, but it's never something that I was asked about. I think I was 9 or 10 years old. And so it was an experience. I saw something that didn't look at all like what I considered to be a UFO. I had a culture-bound idea of UFOs as lights in the sky and things happening at night in the dark, colorful lights, like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I was born, you know, in the 70s, so Close Encounters was part of my childhood. So that was the notion I had of what a UFO was as a kid, 9 or 10 years old. But I was in the back of my parents' house outside the city. It was on the side of a little hill. And at the bottom of the hill, there was a very tall tree. And the canopy of this tree was at my eye level as I stood at the back of my parents' house. And a thing came and passed in between me and the tree. So I knew it was like 3 meters from my face, maybe 4, not more than 5. It was very, very close. And it looked like a white silver bullet with fluttering strips at the back. It looked ridiculous. But it was not in a ballistic trajectory. It was controlled movement, no control surfaces, no ailerons, no flaps, nothing, no visible propulsion system. It was going in a straight line in a given direction, moving fairly slowly, but fast enough to not be a balloon, absolutely silent. And my reaction, and, you know, everything else is unimportant compared to my reaction as a kid. My reaction when I saw that as a kid was, what the hell? Get out of here. You're not supposed to be here. That was my thought, my overwhelming thought. I was upset, not upset in the sense of being anxious or afraid. I was annoyed. Something that was not supposed to be happening was happening. So get the hell out of here. You're not supposed to be here. And the last thing I remember was having the thought, I know where it's going. It was going down. And I thought, I know where it's going to land. I'm going to go there. And then I don't remember shit anymore. That's the end of my memory. So that was my introduction to what I consider to be the real UFO phenomenon, not the Close Encounter lights and aliens from another planet that are completely different and separate from us. I was watching this new Netflix series that was made public this week, I think, Encounters.
Right.
And in the second episode about the Ariel school in Zimbabwe, towards the end of the episode, one of the students, who is now an adult, I thought he had the most thoughtful perspective on the phenomenon that I have ever seen anyone have. There is one intelligent, observant human being. He said, maybe the UFO and the aliens are not about the question of whether we are alone. they are about the question of what are we? And I thought, this is it. He nailed it. You know, that's one intelligent human being. If I could, I would shake his hand. he thinks more deeply than most philosophers in the world today. So, and that's what I gathered out of my own experience, and my own psychological reaction to it betrays a much closer relationship between us and the phenomenon than the simple narrative of aliens from another star system coming here in beryllium spaceships would indicate. And that's why I think Jacques Vallée is on the money. He has been on the money for 5 decades now. And he is the person that we should read very avidly to get a better grip on this. I never really studied UFO literature, so that's why I asked you, do you mean literature? Because if that's what you mean, I never really studied it because I'm repulsed by most of it. I think most of it is beyond silly, if not deliberately, you know, commercial and deliberate lies to make money. I don't like most of the characters that I see in the community. So I don't really engage and participate much. But yeah, there is this thing that happened to me. You know, even if there were no UFO literature and no characters selling books, that thing would still have happened to me. And 20 years ago, I was watching a documentary on Discovery Channel, when the Discovery Channel was still something. And it was about UFOs. I was casually watching it. I didn't choose to watch it. It was not TV on demand like today. You know, you just turn on the TV and it was playing. There was a documentary about UFOs. And they interviewed someone who described exactly the same thing I saw. A bullet-shaped object with these little strips fluttering behind it without making a sound. The difference is that he said it was far in the horizon. And therefore, it was supposed to be a very big craft. And the one I saw was between me and the tree, a tree that was 10 meters away from me. So that thing was not more than than 5 meters away from me. And it was about a meter in length.
And did you perceive that as technology of some sort, or something organic, or something just absurd that doesn't fit our categories, or what?
Totally absurd. Yeah, I wouldn't be able to tell you. I can't put it in a drawer and tell you, well, it was organic or it was technology. It was incongruous. I didn't even think of it as a UFO when I was going through the experience. I mean, it was later that I thought, oh, maybe that's what people are referring to when they talk about UFO. Because in my child's mind, a UFO was supposed to be a piece of metal technology with light. And it was, you were supposed to see it at night, not in the middle of a sunny afternoon, which is what happened to me. And you're not supposed to have the kind of thoughts I had. You're supposed to be in awe, like, oh my God, I'm seeing a UFO. No, I didn't have that reaction at all. I was pissed. Like, get the hell out of here. You're not supposed to be here. Where the hell did it come from? I have no idea. I do not have a narrative in my own mind to account for that. But now I'm old enough that I have accepted that I don't and probably will not have a narrative to account for that. And the other peculiar thing is my memories stop at a crucial point when I was about to go after it. And then I don't remember anything.
And so that's really interesting, of course, because a part of the literature is missing time and gaps in perception, right? I had an experience one time in a hotel room where it seemed like my behavior didn't reflect what I would normally do. So it made me wonder about some sort of intervention there, even in my consciousness. But after that, knowing, for instance, that you had no way to account for the lack of memory at that one point, and because it was such an absurd experience, even for a 9 or 10-year-old, I'm curious to ask you this, because this happens to so many people that have this anomalous kind of experience. Did you just lock it away somewhere and forget about it for 20 years and then revisit it when you came across idealism? Or where did you put it as you grew in your understanding about the nature of reality?
Early on, my natural reaction to it was to ignore it. It's that thought, it's just one of those things, which is a peculiar kind of attitude to have, because in principle, I'm a curious person. I was a scientist. Now I'm a philosopher. And my whole life is about curiosity and investigation. Why do I sort of separate this one thing? Okay, now you don't need to think about that one. Just forget about that one. It's like there is... I don't want to be misinterpreted in what I'm about to say. I don't mean to draw all kinds of implications from what I am about to say, but it's almost as if it's programmed. Like, you're not supposed to care about that. No. You care about everything else. You're curious about everything else, but that you just leave it alone, which is in line with the attitude I had during the site, which was, get out of here. You're not supposed to be here. So in the same sense, we are not supposed to question it very much. Just leave it be. Know what I mean? It was only as an adult that that I started forcing the inquiry. Like, that was one of the defining experiences of my childhood. How come I'm not a little more curious about it? And to this day, it still requires effort to be curious about it. My natural behavior would be to, I have other things to do. I have other challenges. I have to figure this and that out. Whatever that was, something within me knows that I do not need to bother about it. It's not part of this game. That's the feeling.
That's fascinating to me because, again, that's such a common element of people having experience with anomalous things. I like what you said. I understand that you don't like to go down this avenue, but when you self-reflect and being a self-aware person, knowing that this is not your usual nature to just be so incurious about something so curious, and yet you seem almost like you're saying that you do have the sense that every time you do choose to reflect on it, it takes effort, almost like you have to dig it out of some sort of a programmed apathy or something.
Yeah, I think something in us knows. And whatever that thing in us is that knows, also knows that this isn't the game to be played right here, right now.
See, that's fascinating. And this relates to what you were saying earlier about, and I agree with you on that second episode that focused on John Mack, by the way, in Encounters and his experience with the kids at the Ariel School in Zimbabwe. I agree that one comment that one guy made was definitely really pertinent when he said, who are we? What are we? Right? And even what you're pointing to here, some part of you knows the game. It's almost like some part of you surrenders some knowledge in order to explore consciousness as an individual unit. This is a really interesting notion and sort of fits in with Advaita Vedanta and non-duality in general and the idea of source consciousness and different personas, or as you say, alters of the one sort of original mind. But speaking of that, and sort of trying to make sense of these parts that are absurd versus parts that do seem to, as Jacques Vallée points out, part of the challenge with this phenomenon is it does appear physical as well. I think we've heard the term before, paraphysical. It's both physical and not. One of my podcasts is called Liminal Frames exactly because of this. And even John Mack really challenged the mainstream view even back in the 90s and said, why can't something be both real and somehow not real at the same time, some sort of liminal kind of state? So when you recently posted on X/Twitter about sort of three major shifts coming, one being a shift from physicalism to idealism, another one to do with our misunderstanding of time, and the third one being about the revelation of non-human intelligence in our midst all along, I'm sure part of that came from the surprise of the David Grush allegations. I remember you actually posting on this and saying you actually were kind of caught by surprise. So as someone who's entertained the absurd aspect and even what are you call sort of weak elements of objectivity, we can get to that. But when you hear this notion of actual recovered bodies sitting Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and recovered craft has led to technological breakthroughs, how do you wrestle that through?
My intuition about the phenomenon was that it does obviously have a physical face. It can be picked up by radar. It can be photographed. It leaves imprints on the ground. So it definitely does have a physical face. But my intuition, I never really wrote it explicitly in absurdity, but my intuition was it's a unstable physical face, like the Hasdalen lights. It has an obvious physical face. It can be picked up by a radar. It can be photographed. You can do spectral measurements, all kinds of things. But it evanesces. And Jacques Vallée talks a lot about it in his corpus, that many UFOs, they don't just shoot up into the sky. They just fade out of existence. They just sort of disappear. So my intuition was that the physical phase is unstable. But if you have a spaceship or a ship in a military base for the past 80 years, then that's a pretty stable physical phase, right? It's not something that evanesces on its own. So, but my surprise is not that it is also physical. I've known this all along. It is also physical. My surprise is the stability of the physical phase. That was unexpected to me. On the other hand, there is nothing fundamental in this. Whether the physical phase is unstable or not, the fact that there is a physical phase, that is the important thing. How stable it is a matter of degree. We all also have unstable physical phases. Wait another 100 years and look at us, and you will see how unstable our physical phase is. But it was not what I was expecting. But thinking about it conceptually and more clearly now, without, you know, intuitions and emotions, it doesn't really change my view of the phenomenon, because it's a matter of degree, not of the fundamentals of the phenomenon.
Right. And speaking of that, one of the theories that's been put forward, even Jacques Vallée historically did this in the 70s, once he and people like J. Allen Hynek recognized that the traditional extraterrestrial hypothesis wasn't suitable to incorporate all of the high strangeness involved in the phenomenon. But when people often talk about interdimensionals, they're still talking about like physicalist kind of perspectives on universes, right? And people would say, well, it's blipping out because it's going into another physical universe in addition to our physical universe. So as an idealist and thinking of dreamscapes and mental constructs within mind at large, how do you think about that differently?
We all have this culture-bound dualist intuition that there is something physical and there is something other and separate from physicality, which is mentation, and they are related in some way. We don't quite know how, but these are different things. That's what you have in your mind when you say that, oh, Bernardo, if I stick a needle in your arm, a very material event, you will recoil in pain, a very mental event. Therefore, material things cause mental things. That's this culture-bound dualist intuition. Under idealism, material things are the extrinsic appearances of mental processes. In other words, matter, physicality, the contents of the screen of perception, is what mental processes look like when observed from the outside. Matter is, in Kantian terminology, phenomenon, while mental processes are the noumenon, the thing in itself. So for an idealist, that needle that you stick into my arm is the appearance of a mental process by means of which external mental states penetrate the boundaries of my own mental states and cause pain. What that process looks like to observation is a needle piercing my skin. In that, from that perspective, all physical UFOs are the extrinsic appearance of mental processes, and therefore that the phenomenon has a direct psychic component. In other words, that it sort of messes with your mind, is not that extraordinary, because under idealism, the phenomenon is fundamentally mental, experiential, psychic. And the physical phase of it is just an external appearance. And beyond that appearance, it may have an arch of causality that's more direct, that is not intermediated by the screen of perception. So all UAPs and all airplanes and everything that we call physical are the extrinsic appearances of mental processes. Now, this does add to our ability to explain the phenomenon, because it's no longer confusing that it's both physical and psychic, because it's fundamentally psychic, and the physicality is just an extrinsic appearance from a certain perspective of observation. So that's how I regard it. And that's also part of my reasons for being surprised that some of these things can be in a hangar for 80 years. But yeah, it is. That's nature. That's how nature is. Under idealism, and that's my view, the world we inhabit is a cognitive world. We are surrounded by mental processes that are not part of our own dissociated individual mental life. What we call the physical world is just what this mental surrounding looks like when perceived through the screen of perception, which has evolved to pick out from everything around us only what is directly relevant for our survival, so we don't undergo cognitive overload. So perception is a stringent filter dedicated to survival and fitness. But there may be a lot more going on in the cognitive environment that surrounds us and within which we live than what can be picked up by perception. And I would go as far, and that's what I wrote in Meaning and Absurdity, I would go as far as to say that not only is this mental environment in which we are immersed all the time essentially not physical, because physicality is just its appearance, not its essence, it may even transcend our logic. And our logic is based on the five axioms of Aristotelian logic. And we believe them because they seem to be self-evident, but of course you cannot logically argue for the validity of logic without begging the question or engaging in circular reasoning. So the edifice of our reason is built on very shaky foundations, five axioms that we have no reason to believe them other than the fact that they seem to work most of the times, not even always. So the absurdity of the phenomenon may have to do with the fact that nature doesn't comply to the logic axioms of a primate. It doesn't comply to the limits of what a primate takes to be self-evident. We are monkeys. What do monkeys know about what is self-evident? The degrees of freedom of nature stands to reason to think that they go much beyond what we can accommodate in our little conceptual narratives. And we are inside nature. We are surrounded by this cognitive environment in which not even the rules of our monkey logic are necessarily applying. And the phenomenon may be a sort of a protrusion of this world in which we were born and in which we are always immersed, protrudes into the screen of perception, which is perhaps not what is supposed to happen because we evolved to filter it out. And maybe that's why I looked at that thing and said, get the hell out of here. You're not supposed to be here, or I'm not supposed to be seeing in you. But the phenomenon may be the very bed in which we are lying down. It may be the very air which we are breathing all the time. It may be surrounding us, hugging us at all times. And it's not logical, because why would nature limit itself to the logical axioms of a monkey?
Absolutely, which goes back to what I was saying earlier about Donald Hoffman and how his work along with yours has helped, I think, move the conversation along in terms of understanding that what we perceive as reality is a very different question than the actual nature of reality. And when we sort of assume one is the other, then we get into all sorts of hot water. And to your point there, one thing I've done is to actually practice this in terms of lucid dreaming. So I've become pretty good at lucid dreaming. And so one of the things I'll do in a lucid dream, and I've given this example on my podcast, one time I came up against this school building, was this kind of red brick, this rough red brick. And I rubbed the palm of my hand against the school building and I felt like tearing of my skin, right? So if I said to people the next day, I think I actually dreamed something physically real, and they would say, what do you mean? I would say, well, because I felt tearing in my skin. It's consistent. The model is consistent within itself. But I point out to people, you may think that's ridiculous because you said to me, well, you were dreaming. And then I say, well, how do you know what you're doing right now isn't part of the same thing? Just because it's inherently self-consistent doesn't mean it's actually base reality. But on that point, in talking about these different sort of dreamscapes that might interpenetrate, right? Because partly there's also this history in the UFO phenomenon where it almost seems like different reality structures are interpenetrating. So again, people from a physicalist model think those are like different universes interpenetrating and that kind of thing. But if this is really about mental constructs, different sort of dreams held within mind at large kind of thing, one way I might think about it, I'm curious for your take on this, is whether or not some of these other beings have the capacity, unlike us, to move between these dreamscapes, and that partly what they're doing when they're disappearing, apparently, is actually moving from one dreamscape to another. I'm just curious how you think about that.
We, of course, have the tendency to apply our categories even when we are overtly trying to avoid applying our categories. So when we talk about the phenomenon being extra-dimensional and belonging to another reality, we inadvertently still apply our categories. We think of that other reality as extended, as having its own space and time and dimensions. We think of a sort of that other reality intersecting with ours as a kind of physical intersection, like a road intersection. So we are still applying our categories. We are still applying extinction, space, extinction, time, logic, which we have. Even if we surrender to the possibility that the laws of physics in another reality may be different, which is easy to surrender to nowadays because our understanding of physics and, you know, the value of the fundamental constants, it has evolved enough for us to understand that physics is what it is for no good reason. It seems to be arbitrary. It seems like nature could have done something else. So we are able to conceive of another reality as obeying other laws of physics, but we are fundamentally incapable most of the times of thinking of that other reality as not obeying the five axioms of Aristotelian logic. So we are always surreptitiously applying our categories, even when we overtly are trying to precisely avoid that. We apply extension, we apply logic, and that may not be what's going on. Space and time are probably cognitive categories. Kant and Schopenhauer already said that 2.5 centuries ago. Modern research in the neuroscience of or the cognitive science of time shows that time is very malleable. Then Einstein and general theory of relativity and the idea of the block universe shows that time is relative. And then you now have loop quantum gravity questioning the very existence of time as a fundamental dimension of the world. It may be just a byproduct of some more fundamental mathematical relationships, so to say. So there is no good reason for us to think of the phenomenon as just another extended logical world that somehow geometrically intersects with us. That's applying monkey categories to something that is not restricted to monkey categories, if you know what I mean. But it's very difficult for us, especially as a culture, to do that because we desperately need closure. We need to have closure. We need to have a neat narrative that accounts for everything. And that has not always been the case. Previous civilizations and cultures, even we ourselves, prior to the Enlightenment, we could live with uncertainty. We could live without closure. Because we derived meaning from faith. But with the Enlightenment project, particularly from the 19th century, middle of the 19th century onwards, we've lost that source of meaning, transcendent meaning. Meaning coming from what is not only unknown, but unknowable. We lost our ability to have a psychological relationship with the unknowable. We've completely lost that ability late in the 19th century. Ergo logical positivism and other crap. And because of that, we need to fluidly compensate. This is a technical term in psychology, fluid compensation. If you lose a source of meaning, you would drift towards another to compensate for it. And you would do that automatically, subconsciously. And another source of meaning is closure, which essentially means we don't control this shit. We are going to die at the end. It's all a piece of crap, but at least we figured it out. And it's very important for us, since we have lost our ability to relate to the unknowable, it's very important to us to stick to closure as a source of meaning. Otherwise, we are in free fall. So we will always apply monkey categories to stuff that is not monkey-like at all.
Indeed, I really loved your, I think you've done two versions of your analytic idealism course now, but I remember the first one that was a multi-part series on YouTube. And I love how you make the point that to even make the arguments you're making, you kind of have to cheat a little bit and describe some things through metaphors or pictures just to allow people to make the transition, right? Whereas even someone like Nima Arkani Ahmed's really going to the depth of physics is saying that the math itself is suggesting that space-time is not foundational. It must be derivative of some deeper process. And to think that that deeper process is not spatial-temporal at all. So when people ask for what does it look like and how does it show up in time, those are questions that are kind of absurd to even ask based on that, right?
I think we don't need to surrender completely. We are never going to get an intuitive grasp of what reality is beyond extension. In other words, without space and time. And the reason is we have a very difficult time understanding that there can be structure without extension. Because if there is no extension, no space and time, then everything collapses into a uniform singularity. That's what we like to think. For there to be structure, you have to extend things. But that's not necessarily the case. We can visualize structure as an unfathomable web of cognitive associations. Cognitive associations don't need extension to exist. For instance, if I associate white with peace, this association can exist outside of extension. It doesn't need to exist in space. It doesn't need to exist in time. So we can think of reality prior to extension, prior to space and time, as a kind of a cosmic database of cognitive associations, associations based on similarity, but similarity in a much broader context than just form similarity, similarities of semantics. So we can think of reality as a semantic database, as a sort of a set of semantical archetypes, templates of behavior that do not need extension to exist, and that web of cognitive association has structure, unfathomably rich structure, without needing extension. It can have an extended embodiment. For instance, if your city hall's database, your city hall has a database. It has the files of every citizen, and these files are associated. Your file is associated with your mother and father. It's associated with the file corresponding to the house you own, to your kids, to your place of work. There are all these semantic associations of meaning across the files in your city's database, which has an extended embodiment, hard disk drives or SSDs or paper files in cartoon boxes. It has an extended embodiment. But if your city hall went up in flames and all those files just disappeared, would you stop being your mother's son or your children's father? Would you stop having the aptitudes you have, the knowledge you have? No, those semantic associations exist without the extended database. They are prior to that because they are associations of meaning. I think we can visualize reality as its most fundamental level, as a database of meaning associations, and the world we see as a physical embodiment of that database. But if the physical embodiment went up in flames, nothing would be lost because all the semantic associations are there in the fabric of reality.
Indeed. And I know that even Jacques Vallée has talked about that as well, that reality might be more like an algorithm within a socially connected database, like a relational database. And that sometimes even these slippages in what seem like space-time might be like a connection between two of these that is just not the usual default connection we make. And I think too of Carl Jung here and his sense that he sort of inferred sometimes or implied around physical reality being the flip side, the other side of the coin of the collective unconscious, right? And I know that you wrote a great book about Carl Jung. I'm just curious to ask you about his take and your take on synchronicity in light of what you just described there.
So Jung noticed in the course of his life that there were coincidences that happening not only his life, the lives of his patients, and of which he had many, that were not only coincidental, but were very meaning charged. They were very meaningful coincidences. He speaks of a therapy session with one of his patients talking about death and rebirth. And then exactly when that conversation was taking place, a scarab, a beetle, flew in through the window, a golden beetle, which was very rare in Küsnacht. I think it's inexistent in Küsnacht today, but 100 years ago, it was very rare. And of course, the scarab is the symbol of rebirth. So it was a very, very meaningful coincidence. It was the only time a beetle ever flew into Jung's home office. And it happened exactly when this woman was talking about the appropriate thing. I can speak of it in my own life as well. There are synchronicities I even recorded in my book, which are impossible to just dismiss. So for Jung, the first idea he had, and which he debated with Wolfgang Pauli, the Nobel Prize winner known for the Pauli exclusion principle in quantum mechanics, they came up with this scheme in which there are two orthogonal organizing principles in nature. One is causality. Things are associated with one another through chains of cause and effect. But the other orthogonal one was synchronicity. Things would happen together when the meaning they evoked would be aligned. And that would be acausal. In other words, it would be inconsistent for you to ask yourself what caused the beetle to enter Jung's room. Because if you did that, you would be appealing to causality, which is one organizing principle. Synchronicity is not supposed to be based on causality. It's supposed to be an orthogonal thing. The beetle came in because the meaning evoked by the beetle and the meaning evoked in the psyche of his patient were aligned. And that's why these things happened together. But later in their discussion, going into the early 50s, Jung and Pauli had, and you can see that in their later letters, Jung was very careful writing to Pauli because Pauli was a very intimidating character, Nobel Prize winning physicist. So Jung, he's almost not Jung because you see that he's trying to be conceptually rigorous when he writes to Pauli. He's not conceptually rigorous at all when in every other aspect of his work. He's intuitive. He's not trying to be conceptually rigorous, but with Pauli he does. So you can see that carefulness in the way the later letters unfold, but with an obvious acknowledgement. Jung and Pauli, they found room for this synchronicity principle, orthogonal to causality. They found room for it in nature, in quantum indeterminism. In quantum mechanics, the statistics of many events are determined, but individual events are not. Only what they average out to is determined, not the outcome of individual events. So individual events are not causally determined, and therefore there is room for synchronicity. That was their thinking in the early discussions, in the early letters. But in the later letters, they realized that if the laws of large numbers, the statistics, the things that are determined, the classical laws of nature, if they are the emergent result of the microscopic phenomena, which are not determined by causality, then if the microscopic are actually synchronistic, then so must the macroscopic be. So they arrive at the conclusion, which is hardly explicitly acknowledged, but it's clear enough in the letters, that synchronicity is primary and causality is what you get when you average out the events that are determined through relationships of meaning alignment. And that dovetails very nicely with what I just said before. If the nature at its foundation is a web of semantic associations, what is semantic association? It's an association of meaning. It's things that mean similar things coming together, expressing themselves together. If that is the case, then causality is just our word for the patterns we detect when these meaning associations are averaged out. In other words, there is no causality. There is only synchronicity. There is only semantic associations, webs of meaning. Everything else is a product of that through its unfolding, its exfoliation.
And that brings us to an end of part one of this two-part conversation with Bernardo Castro. Be sure to tune in next time when we discuss issues such as transpersonal forces expressing themselves through people in what are colloquially referred to as daemons or diamonds, how the process of evolution could eventually serve up what we perceive as shape-shifting aliens or non-human intelligence, and the notion of humanity being an engineered species. All this and more coming in part two of my conversation with philosopher Bernardo Castro. Be sure to tune in then. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian, signing out.